Okay. Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to me. Why not? We are Sukkot Daf Chafalef. We'll start the second parak today of the Masechta. Thank the Lupin Foundation for sponsorship of the Daf. We'll learn the Daf. L'zecher Nishmas Lupin Zaltzman. We are in the very top of Chaf Amud Beis, and we begin the second parak. Now, just to simplify, and perhaps oversimplify, the difference between the first parak and the second parak, as we talked about in the beginning of the Masechta, there are five prakim to this Masechta. So prakim 1 and 2 is about the mitzvah of Sukkah. Prakim 3 and 4 is about the mitzvah of Lulav, Hadassah, Maravas, and Esrog, the Dalaminim. And parak 5 is about Beis HaMikdash, what life was like in Sukkot in the Beis HaMikdash. So those are your five prakim of the Masechta. So we are in the second parak, so we're still talking about the mitzvah of Sukkah. So can we differentiate between the first and the second parak, meaning what's the breakdown? So again, just to oversimplify, the first parak was about building the sukkah. So basically, it was more about structure. And how do we take a sukkah and build it from the ground up? And the second parak, so we're going to talk a little bit more about function. We'll talk more about how to live in the sukkah and how to eat in the sukkah. So but that's a simplification that you'll see in the second over the course of the second parak. It's 10 blad of Gemara. It starts here. It ends up around Chav Tes. In the second parak, we're also going to talk a lot about structure of the sukkah. So my breakdown, although I like to think it's really organized, but there's going to be a little bit of overlap. In the meantime, however, we start the first mishnah of the second parak. Hayashen tachas amita b'sukkah lo yasi yedei chavasa. Don't sleep under the bed. Don't sleep under the bed when you're in a sukkah. Okay, what's the problem? The problem is very simple. The mitzvah in the Torah is to sleep in the sukkah. That's the mitzvah in the Torah. Rashi points out, the ikar yeshivas of sukkah, the main mitzvah of sukkah is achila shtia v'shena. We're going to be hitting this idea again and again. In other words, we're supposed to be living in the sukkah, and we need living activities in the sukkah. Living activities are eating, drinking, and sleeping. It is interesting that the Mishnah is really focusing on the sleeping, which is also interesting because that's probably the least of what we do nowadays in the sukkah. It's difficult. It's not people. I know people who do it. I know people who are successful at it. I've tried and I've failed, but it's really difficult. But fine. But the mitzvah in the sukkah is to eat, to drink, and to sleep. So the Mishnah says that you can't sleep under the bed. And the reason why, presumably, is because when you're under the bed, so now you're under a separate shelter, meaning the bed itself is a shelter. Well, let's give it a halachic terminology to Noel. And so therefore, what's happening now is that you're not in the sukkah. You're within a sukkah within a sukkah. And a bed, obviously, is not a kosher sukkah. So the problem is that you are in an ohel within the sukkah, and that's why you can't sleep under the bed. Right? Probably, presumably. In fact, we'll make this point even clearer in just a moment. I'm Rav Yehuda Noagim Hayinu Sheinu Yishem Tachas Hamita B'Pnei HaZaken. Rav Yehuda vociferously disagrees. Rav Yehuda says that, no, we slept under the bed. In fact, we did so in front of the Zakenim, v'lo amru lanu davar, and they didn't say anything to us. They didn't protest to us at all. So in other words, Rav Yehuda is of the belief that we are allowed to sleep under the bed in a sukkah, for reasons which we'll explain later on this morning. I'm Rabbi Shimon Maisa B'Tevi Avdash Rami Gamliel. Rabbi Shimon tells a story regarding Tevi, the servant of Rami Gamliel. Tevi was an Eved Kanani. Eved Kanani, as we'll be discussing over the course of this morning, has the same status in terms of halacha and his obligation to mitzvahs as that of a woman. A woman is exempt from the mitzvah of sukkah. Sukkah is a time-bound mitzvah. Therefore, women are exempt. If women are exempt, so too are Eved Kanani. So Tevi was actually exempt from the mitzvah of sukkah. And Rami Gamliel now telling a story about his slave Tevi. So he was sleeping under the bed in the sukkah. Rami Gamliel said to the Zakenim, Tevi Avdi. So Rami Gamliel, it was conversation. It wasn't, he wasn't trying to make a halachic point. It was just simple conversation. My servant Tevi, so who tamachacham? Right, he's knowledgeable. V'yodesh avadim p'tur min ha-sukkah. So he knows that avadim are exempt from the mitzvah of sukkah. So l'fichach yashenu tachas hamita, and therefore he sleeps under the bed in the sukkah. In other words, he's in the sukkah, but he's under the bed, so he's not fulfilling the mitzvah of sukkah, which is fine because he's an avid, and that's fine. L'fidar kin l'manu shayeshen tachas hamita lo yatzi yidei chavasa. And oh, by the way, ends the Mishnah. We learn from the statement of Rami Gamliel that if you are obligated in the mitzvah of sukkah and you sleep under a bed, you have not fulfilled the mitzvah of sukkah. Okay, adkan. Okay, so the first topic of discussion is you got to sleep in the sukkah. You can't be in a bed, under the bed, in a sukkah. Now, the Gemara starts off with the discussion right away. But the bed is not 10 tefachim high. The Gemara is making an assumption. The assumption of the Gemara is that the bed is only going to negate the sukkah if the height of the bed is 10 tefachim off the ground, okay? Which is a pretty high area. Meaning you're talking about a bed where it's about 3 feet, approximately 3 feet off the ground. So the Gemara says, under those circumstances, I could see the bed serving as its own oel. But if the bed, it doesn't have 10 tefachim, if the bed itself is not 10 tefachim high off the ground, why should the bed constitute an oel? So to which the Gemara's answer is, Tirgama Shmuel, Bimita Asara Tanan. Sorry, Bimita Asara. So Shmuel's explanation of the Mishnah is, no, okay, you're right, we're talking about a better bed that's 10 tefachim high. Period. Okay. Now, period over here, now what is Shmuel basically saying? This whole discussion of our Mishnah of not sleeping under the bed is only when the bed is 10 tefachim high. If the bed is less than 10 tefachim high, then there's no problem whatsoever. Because the bed itself doesn't constitute an ohel. Okay.
Will the table be the same thing as the bed?
And lich ora. Now, let's go back to a discussion. This is now the third time we're having this discussion, which is fine. The more the better. It just means we're going to get to review more often. But in other words, in Tosos, the first Tosos on our Perek makes this very point. I'm just simply summarizing Tosos' point. You go back all the way to Daf Yud. You remember the discussion we had back on Daf Yud in the Masechta, where we said that you're not allowed to sleep sukkah tachat sukkah. You're not allowed to be in a sukkah tachat sukkah. Meaning that when you're in a sukkah, you cannot have a qualified sukkah above it. Okay, that's why not. It's based on a drasha. Okay, the Gemara Daf Yud explains, but fine. So in other words, so your sukkah cannot be built underneath another sukkah. Okay. Remember the discussion we had back then? When we talked about sukkah tachat sukkah, how big does the top sukkah have to be in order to invalidate the sukkah underneath it? So if you remember, there were three opinions over there. If you remember, Shmuel was the one who said that the top sukkah has got to be 10 tefachim high. And his argument is very reasonable. Kehechshero, kach psulo. Well, a kosher sukkah has to be 10 tefachim high. So if you have this invalidation of sukkah tachat sukkah, the invalidation only will be if the top sukkah is 10 tefachim high. Anything less than that, and it doesn't invalidate the sukkah. So, that was Shmuel back on Daf Yud, and it happens to be, who is the one who explained our Mishnah? Shmuel. So as Tosos points out, it seems to be that we have a consistency between Shmuel and Shmuel. Tosos then therefore wonders, what about the other opinions back on Daf Yud? So if you remember, there were two other opinions. One says that if the top sukkah is only 4 tefachim high, which admittedly is not a kosher sukkah, but if it's 4 tefachim high, that will invalidate the sukkah below it. There's even a third opinion that if the upper sukkah is only 1 tefach high, that will invalidate the sukkah below it. So Tosos wonders, are they going to be arguing with Shmuel's opinion over here? And our parak, are they going to be of the opinion that even if the bed is 4 tefachim high or 1 tefach high, so then that bed is going to disqualify the sukkah? So Tosos basically says 2 points. Either, number one, we may be right. In other words, there may be a consistent position on Daf Yud as there is on Daf Chaf in the first mission of the second parak. Or Tosos suggests, maybe no. Maybe everybody would be in agreement that in our discussion, it would be different. For what reason would it be different? If you take a look at the end of this first Tosfos, so this Shema, perhaps, Tosfos writes, Mita Shani. Maybe a bed would be different. Why should a bed be different? Kedamra Bigmar Davila Mita Oal Arai. Because the bed is an Oal Arai. Meaning, a bed is not made for living underneath the bed. The whole purpose of the bed is to be on top of the bed. So when you crawl underneath the bed and you're hiding from whatever's in the closet that's scaring you, so that's not the fundamental purpose of a bed. And so therefore, Tosfos suggests maybe everyone's in agreement, meaning all the Amoraim who disagree with Shmuel back on Daf Yud, maybe there would be an agreement that when it comes to a bed has to be 10 tefachim high. Maybe. That's Tosfos' suggestion. Okay. We are now going to start the next question answer. The Gemara, this is a long-worded question coming up. The Gemara will take nearly an amud to formulate a question, and then after the formulation of the question, then the Gemara is going to answer. Okay, so, let's see, let's start it off. Okay, here we go, the beginning, an introduction to a question. Tanan Hasam. The first thing we get to learn together is the Mishnah Ovelos. Now, we all understand that when you have remains, when you have human remains, it gives off tumah. B'maga b'masa b'ohel. Either by contact, by physical contact with the human remains, or by carrying the human remains, or ohel, or being underneath the same tent. So if you and the human remains are sharing the same tent, if the human remains are in this room, So the tumah goes up, hits the roof, spreads out, comes back down, and makes everything else in this room tameh, even though there's no contact. There was simply no contact, no picking up. Okay, this is what's called tumas ohel. Okay, what constitutes an ohel? So we've said this time and again. An ohel is, it has to be a vertical height of only one tefach, and the roof itself only needs to be one tefach by one tefach. When you have those dimensions, so then it qualifies as an ohel, and the tumah gets to be spread out. What if it's a natural ohel, right? Like a crevice, like a rock formation. So is a natural ohel going to be considered an ohel? So according to the accepted halacha and according to the Tanakhama, the answer is yes. According to Rabbi Yehuda, the answer presumably is going to be no. A natural forming ohel is not give off tumas ohel, for reasons which we'll explain in just a moment. So the first thing we'll do together is we'll see a Mishnah in Ohalos. Tanan Hasim, we learned in the Mishnah in Ohalos, Echadchor, Shecharo, Mayim. It's either the natural tent is formed by water running underneath, Oshratzim, or it was dug out by bugs, Oshachasim, Alachas, or maybe it was corrosion, some saline corrosion, Chen Midbach, Avanim, or simply a row of stones where it creates a natural ohel, v'chein savar shel karas, or a pile of beams, ma'al al ha-tumah, creates an ohel for tumah. Okay, so the Tanakhama's position is that a natural forming ohel still constitutes an ohel. Rav Yehuda omer kol ohel she'eino asa bidei adam, eino ohel. And Rav Yehuda simply disagrees. Rav Yehuda says no. An ohel, by definition, has to be man-made. If it is not man-made, if it's naturally formed, it does not serve as an ohel. My taima, the Rebbe Yehuda. Why? How do we know this? So this is now the Gemara's explanation. The Mishnah doesn't say this. But my taima, the Rebbe Yehuda, yalef ohel, mi mishkan. So it learns it out based on Gzeira Shava. From this week's Parsha, Ksiv Hacha, well, first we go to Parsha's Chukas, Zos HaTorah Adam Ki Yamos Ba'ol, a person dies in an ohel, Ksiv Hasam, Vayifros Es Ha'ol Al HaMishkan. And he spreads the ohel on top of the Mishkan. So in other words, the ohel that's discussed in this week's Parsha, the ohel for the Mishkan, so that's obviously man-made. So Rav Yehuda says, that creates the basis for all ohalos. In order for it to be an ohel, it has to be man-made. So malahalam bidei adam, afkan bidei adam. So that's the position of Rabbi Yehuda. Okay, Tosus wonders. We're not going to go through the Tosus inside, but Tosus wonders if we're really creating a gzera from the Mishkan. So then we should further define what an ohel is, because we know that the Mishkan is made from orosizim. It's made from the hides of goats, and so why don't we further limit its definition of what an ohel is? Tosus has that discussion, but fine. That's the gzera shava of Rabbi Yehuda. Virabanan. Ohel riba, and the Chachamim say that the Torah uses the word ohel multiple times in Parshas Chukas. It comes to include even naturally formed ohelos. Fine. But the first step, so step one in this whole discussion is, according to Rav Yehuda, a natural ohel is not considered an ohel. That's step one. V'sav Rav Yehuda kol she'eino asa bidei adam eino ohel v'riminu. The Gemara says, okay, but with that, however, we have a problem because we know the Mishnah Parah. Well, we don't know the Mishnah Parah yet. We're going to go through it right now. And the Mishnah Parah will describe the following. Now, before we get to this description, it will be one of the most fantastic descriptions that we're going to see throughout Shas. But before we get to the description, let me just give a little bit of background so we understand what's about to happen and what this Mishnah Parah is talking about. The Parah Aduma is a process in which we take a red cow, burn it, take some Mayim Chaim, some natural spring water. I'm oversimplifying. Mix the two together, and anyone who's subject to Tumas Meis, anyone who came into contact with dead, so with human remains, so gets sprinkled with the Paraduma on day 3 and day 7, Tovas in the Mikvah on day 7, and it becomes Tahor. Okay, that was the Cliff Note version of Tumah, of Taharas at Tumas Meis, purification from becoming Tameh Meis. Okay, in terms of the preparation of the ashes in the water, so the Torah describes that an ish tahor, that a pure man is going to be involved in the burning of the Parah Aduma. Okay. Now here we have the great divide, one of the great divides between those who hold by the Torah Shebaal Peh, which I'd venture to say is all of us in this room. Let me assume that. And those who don't hold of the Torah Shebaal Peh. Now, if you don't hold of the Torah Shebaal Peh, if you don't have the oral tradition, and all you have to work with is just Chumash, so when the Torah describes the person burning the Parah Aduma and describing him as an Ish Tahor, so you would say, what does Ish Tahor mean? It means that he's pure. It means that he's not Tameh at all. That's the if that's your explanation of the Chumash, so that's a literalist, or if you want to give another term, you're Tzaduki. Okay, that's all you got. We, however, have the Torah Shabbat Peh, so we know, based on the Torah Shabbat Peh, just we'll put it under the category of Perushim HaMukubalim. This is just simply the pshat that was handed to Moshe, and that is, Ish Tahor means he's not fully Tahor. Ish Tahor simply means he came into contact with Toma, he toveled in the mikvah, and that's enough. Now, that's not enough in terms of making him Tahor. He still needs one more component in order for him to become Tahor, and that, of course, is Hair of Shemesh. He needs the sun to set. So in other words, there are two steps to becoming Tahor when you become Tameh. I'm not talking about Tumas Mesim, I'm talking about more or less all the other Tumas. You first tovel in the mikvah, and then from that point going forward, you're called a Tful Yom, and until the sun sets, you are not fully Tahor.
How do they drive that?
Huh?
Do you mean how they drive that? The fact that Tahor means just partially?
Perushim HaMukubalim. I put it under the same category of Ayin Tachazayin. Right, Ayin Tachazayin means monetary value. How do we know that? Perushim HaMukubalim. It's just simply the rabbi.
That's a little more sensible than this. This started like
okay, fine. Doesn't Perushim HaMukubalim doesn't need necessarily to conform to logic? The Gemara in the beginning of the eighth parak of Baba Kama spends two blot of Gemara trying to extract how we know that Ayin Tachazayin means not an eye for an eye, but it means monetary value. But when all said and done, the Rambam writes this, so when all said and done, it's Perushim HaMukubalim. Okay. Anyway, fine. So that's our understanding. Our understanding is that when putting together the Paraduma, the person burning the Paraduma does not have to be fully Tahor. It's sufficient if he tovels in the mikvah. Okay. And here's where we made our stand. Meaning we basically wanted to demonstrate to the Tzedukim, you're wrong. So what we did is that the Kohen who would be burning the Parah Aduma would actually be metame him. We would make him tame prior to the event. He would tovel on the mikvah, so that now he would be in a situation of being a Tful Yom. He didn't have to be a Tful Yom, but lahotzi mi libam shel tzidukim. But to basically voice our dissent to the tzidukim and say, no, this is the way we understand the Torah. We have the tradition. This is Torah Shabbat Peh. This is how we do it. So therefore, we go out of our way to be Mitame the Kohen, who is involved in the Srefa Sapara, and he will now be a Tful Yom. He becomes Tame, he tovels in the mikvah, and immediately after toveling in the mikvah, before nightfall, he's involved in the burning of the Paraduma. Okay. That is the background. Now, with that in mind, so the Chachamim said, you see what we're doing now when it comes to the Paraduma? We're doing something very strange. Now, again, I explained to you the reason why we do it, in order to show that Tzedukim are wrong, but we're doing something very strange. Basically, we're making the person involved in the Paraduma, we're making him Tameh. So, you know, people are going to see that, and people are going to say, all right, so I guess you don't have to be all that Tahor in terms of preparation of the Paraduma. So what the Chachamim instituted was basically a counterbalance. We're basically, now because we're Metameh, the Kohen involved in the burning of the Paraduma, so we're going to go through extraordinary measures just to show people it's not a disregard for Tum and Tahara, but rather it's just simply to show that the Tzedukim are wrong. And on the other side, we're going to go through really extraordinary measures to show that we do care about Tahara. Okay, now we're about to see the Mishnah Parah, and we're going to see these extraordinary measures. I cannot think of something that is, to us, would sound more strange or more bizarre in terms of, you know, religious requirement, but the Mishnah Parah describes it, and I hopefully provided for you the background information so that we're going to begin to understand. So here we go now. This is all the counterbalance. Measures that are taken to ensure the purity of the process of the Paraduma. We're going to have boys, I'm just going to describe it outside and then we'll read it inside. We're going to have boys basically draw the water for the Paraduma. Boys who never came into contact with Tumas Mace. We know it. They never came into contact with Tumas Mace. Not only did they not come into contact with Tumas Mace, not even Suffolk. We're so sure that they never came into contact. In fact, at 8 or 9 years of age, they're going to draw the water, so we also know that they never had a Baal Keri. They never had a seminal discharge. They were just simply too young. These are the ones that are going to be drawing the water, so that now the water is drawn in an extra special state of Tahara. Let's see the Mishnah in Parah inside.
Water for what?
That's the Mayim Chaim. The Mayim Chaim, which will be added to the...
Every day when they needed the water?
No, not every day. For the original preparation.
The original preparation.
Yeah. So, Chatzer is how you benuz by Yerushalayim. So they had a courtyard built in Yerushalayim, Agabe Asela. And it was built over a stone platform. V'tachtem Chalal. Now, the stone platform, by design, had airspace underneath. And all you need is a one tafach airspace. So, Mibnei Kevar to home. Because there's possible burial underneath. Now, we don't know. Meaning, we don't know if there is, we don't know if there isn't. Rashi points out, every time you see the word tahom, it means suffik. Rashi right here on the daf. So it means suffik. So there possibly may be people buried underneath Yerushalayim. Fine. These, I mean, they're not even infants right now. Right now we're just talking about the pregnant mothers, are taken to this chatzar, to this courtyard, built on top of a stone platform, so that if in the event that there is burial underneath, but the stone platform is one tefach of airspace separating the platform and anything below it, so that if the tumah that goes up, tumah stopped by that one tefach airspace. And they would bring pregnant women, they would give birth there. And the children would be raised on that stone platform. Now the Gemara here doesn't say, Rashi points out, Rashi quotes the Tosefta, the children are raised to about 7 or 8 years of age. And so in other words, so the first 7 or 8 years of their life, so they're literally raised in a, almost in a bubble, on the stone platform. Now, at 8 years of age, they're going to be taken to draw the water. So that means now for the first time in their life, they're going to be leaving the stone platform, this chatzar that's in Yerushalayim. I know. I'm aware. This is strange. Let me first get through the Mishnah together, and then I'll respond to questions. So now they're going to take their first ride outside of the stone platform, and they're going to be placed on the backs of oxen. And well, they're not going to ride directly on the backs of oxen, but basically there's going to be a small, what the Mishnah describes as delassos, right? Wooden beams that are on the backs of the oxen. So they're going to get a ride outside on the wooden beam on top of the oxen. Vitinokos Yoshin al Gabayim, and the kids are sitting on the top. Vikoshish Evan Biadeim, now they're using stone cups. Stone cups, as Rashi points out, stone is impervious to tumah. Stone does not become natural stone. Natural stone does not become tame. So therefore they have stone cups. Higil Ishiluach, they get to the well, to the spring, I should say. Yargalotoch Hamayim, they go into the water, umilum, and they drew the water up. Va'alav Yashvulahem, and then they returned with the natural spring water. Okay. Rabbi Yossi Omer Mimkama Yamashasho Mamale. Now Rabbi Yossi happens to be of the opinion that they didn't need to actually get off the back of the ox, but they could stay on the back of the ox and just simply draw with a pulley system. Mimne Kevar Tahom, because if they get off the ox, aren't we concerned that now they are becoming for the first time in their life actually susceptible to any type of tumah? Okay, so therefore, Rav Yossi disagrees. This is not something we're going to focus on right now. There's machlokas between the Tanakam and Rav Yossi. Vitanya. And here we get to the point, which is, Rav Yehuda Omer, lo yamivin delasos el shvarim. So Rav Yehuda basically says, everything we said correct, except for the wooden platforms on the top, on the back of the oxen. The children would not go on the wooden platform on the top of the oxen, but rather ride bareback on the oxen. Okay, and that would be sufficient. Now, why is that sufficient? So as Rashi points out over here, and it's pretty clear, just evident from the Gemara itself, because the back of the oxen provide the necessary ohel so that the child, even if there's tumah underneath, the child will be protected based on what canopy? The actual oxen themselves. They provide the tent that'll protect them from the possible tumah. Now the Gemara over here is bothered by the obvious question. So here we get to a question. We learned the Mishnah together in Oalos. The Mishnah says that according to Rav Yehuda, a natural made Oal is not considered an Oal. That's the Mishnah Oalos. Now we're learning the Mishnah in Parah. The Mishnah in Parah says that the children would ride bareback on the oxen because the oxen provides for them the necessary Oal. An ox is not man-made. It's organic. It's natural. How can the ox serve as an ohel? And not only that, Rav Yehuda even removed the beam. He removed the wooden platform on the back of the oxen. So the Gemara says, I simply don't understand. How does that work? So ki asa Rav Dimi Amar Rav Elazar Modi Rav Yehuda Kimlo Egrov. So the Gemara says there becomes a point of agreement, meaning you're right. There is a fundamental debate between Rav Yehuda and the Tanakhama in the Mishnah Olos. The Tanakhama says that any OL is considered an OL even if it's natural. Rav Yehuda disagrees. Rav Yehuda says no, and only man-made OL is considered OL, but not naturally formed OL. That's a fundamental machlokas. However, as the Gemara now is going to point out, when the OL is large enough, even if it's natural, even if it's not man-made, Rav Yehuda comes to a point of agreement where it's okay. Well, the Gemara describes it as being an egrov, kimlo egrov. Now, an egrov is a fist. Now, exactly how much larger is it than a tefach? So I'm not totally sure. Rashi describes the skylights being made the size of an egrov. Okay, but whatever it is, in other words, it's larger. Right, egrov shel avatiach, Rashi points out. Shel ben avatiach, whatever the case is. The point is that when you get to the point of an egrov, even Rabbi Yehuda will agree that a natural ohel does serve as an ohel.
Would Rabbi Yehuda say that a human body could also act as an ohel?
Unclear.
Unclear.
I'm not sure, but let's just finish this point. Tainami Achim Order Rabbi Yehuda Bishkifim Nekika Eslaim, and the Gemara says, and not only that, I have a brisa that supports this answer, which is that Rabbi Yehuda agrees that when it comes to clefts and crevices of large stone projections, so they're going to form an OL. So good. So that is an understanding of the sheet of Rabbi Yehuda. So the Mishnah in Olos that says Rabbi Yehuda says that an OL has to be man-made, now based on the Mishnah in Parah, so we're going to modify our understanding of Rav Yehuda. It doesn't have to be man-made. It would be sufficient if it were natural, as long as it's the size of an egrov. Right? A larger size. Now, the Gemara says, V'hare dalas di'esh ba'kam egrov and v'kazan Rav Yehuda amar lo yom even dalas asol shvarim. Now the Gemara is just curious. Listen, we just learned the Mishnah in Parah. Can we just get a better understanding of that Mishnah in Parah? Rav Yehuda says, don't let them go on the boards, on the back of the ox, but rather let them ride bareback on the ox. What's wrong with the board? And what do you want to argue? It's not man-made. We just established that as long as it's an egrov, the size of an egrov, even Rav Yehuda would say it would form an ohel. So wonders the Gemara, so what's wrong with what's wrong with the boards? Why does Rav Yehuda have a problem with the boards on the back of the oxen? So Abai gives a very simple answer. It's not, Rav Yehuda has no problem with the boards, they're just simply unnecessary. That's all Rav Yehuda meant. Rava Amar lo, I'm even Delasos called Ikar. No. According to Rava, I'll give a different pshat in the Mishnah and Para. It's not that he was indifferent to the boards, he was anti-boards. Why is he so anti-boards? So the Gemara is according to Rava, because look, you know what's going to happen if you put the boards on the back of the oxen? It'll be a great ride for the kid. The 8-year-old kid on the back of the oxen, but not directly on the back of the oxen, but on a board that was placed on the back of the oxen. He'll be super comfortable on the board. Okay, first time in his life, he's actually leaving the courtyard. But he'll be super comfortable on the board. He'll be so comfortable, in fact, on the board, it'll be like a ride. He'll look over the side. He'll dangle a hand over the side, meaning it'll be too comfortable. And what's the problem with dangling his hand or his head over the side? He may expose himself to tumah. So Rav Yehuda says, this is Rava's understanding of Rav Yehuda, I prefer if he rides bareback because, quite frankly, he'll be terrified. And quite frankly, if he's terrified, he will stay within the confines of the top of the oxen, and he won't peer over, and he prefers that. Tanya Kavasi, the Rava, the Gemara points out, we have a brisa supporting Rava. Rav Yehuda Amar La Yemivin Glosses Kol Iker Mimnei Shadato Shatina Gasalav Shemi Yotzi Rosho Echa Meir Rav Yitame Bekevra Tahom Ela Mivin Shvarim HaMitzrim Shekres Osem Rechavos. The brisa basically says exactly like Rava. Rav is supported by the brisa that we don't want, according to Rav Yehuda, we don't want the boards because they'll be too comfortable, and then he'll peer over with his head or one of his limbs, exposing himself to possible tumah. So therefore, mivin shvarim hamitzrim, get the Egyptian oxen, which in of itself is interesting. Generally speaking, we are not in favor of importation from Egypt, but horses, okay, not oxen, fine. Shekreso seim rechavos. where the wide stomachs, v'tinokos yoshvin al gabeim, and the child is sitting on the back, v'kos ashav biyadeim, and we're just finishing reading the brisa, even though we know all these points already, and they have the stone cups in their hand, higiel shiluach yardumalam v'alav yeshulam al gabeim, and then when they get to the spring, they would go down, they would draw the water, and they would come back up again. Okay, period, and really question mark. Meaning, it took a while for the Gemara to make its point, but now, I said less than an amud, I'm going to retract my statement. More than an amud for the Gemara to formulate its question. And the question basically now goes as follows. We have now put together a Mishnah in Ovelos and a Mishnah in Parah, and now we have formed together a full view of Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda says that a natural formed Ovel is not considered an Ovel, but, as we learned together in the Mishnah in Parah, That's not the full picture. The full picture is that once the tent arrives at an area of an egrof, which is more than a tefach, once it arrived at the area of an egrof, even Rabbi Yehuda would agree, I don't care how the oil was formed. Either it was man-made or it was natural. Rabbi Yehuda says that has the status of an oil, and it has the status of a tent. That is the full view of Rabbi Yehuda, and we now know that as we put together the Mishnah Oelos and the Mishnah Parah. Okay. And all this brings us back to our Mishnah. For what reason? Because our Mishnah says that according to Rabbi Yehuda, you can sleep under the bed. Okay. To which now the Gemara is basically going to ask Rabbi Yehuda, you can sleep under the bed? What are you talking about? The bed's an oel. And what do you want to tell me? Well, it wasn't made for the purpose of oel. Much like a natural formation wasn't made for the purpose of oel. A bed, although you can't say it was naturally formed, I know, but still, its prime design was not designed as an oel. So maybe you want to argue that the bed is not going to serve as an oel, and that's why Rabbi Yehuda is totally comfortable sleeping under the bed. But the Gemara says, but now, again, we now know the full story. The full story of Rabbi Yehuda is that once it's the size of an egrof, I don't care how it was made, man-made, natural-made, it still qualifies as an oel. The bed certainly is the size of an egrof. An egrof is a fist. The bed is certainly the size of an egrof. It's many egrofim. So why would Rabbi Yehuda allow a person to sleep under a bed? This is the Gemara's question. It took the Gemara an Amud to ask the question, but this is the Gemara's question. Before we answer this question, can we just go back for just a quick moment? Just to touch on a couple of points regarding just one basic point. Going back to our child being raised on the courtyard, right? And I know, look, it's interesting. We're trying to protect him from tumah, right? Right. People go to many extremes in order to protect their children from outside influences. Fine. So we're trying to protect him from tumah. Okay. I'm not going to turn this into a sermon. it's not normally my job. But just in the world of halacha. We're protecting him from tumah. What just happened? Let's talk about his birth. Okay, what's happening at his birth? So he's coming out. He's emerging from a mother who's a yoledes, meaning just by the act of birth, mom is tumah, right? And sure he is. In other words, as he's emerging now, he's coming into contact with a mother, and not only is mother a yoledes, but mom's also an ida. So at the point of birth, we went through these very extreme procedures in order to protect him from tumah, but quite frankly, already at the point of birth, he's tummy. If you take a look at the Tosfos back on Chaf Aleph, Tosfos is sensitive to this. Tosfos says, I know this. Alpha P, second Tosfos on the Amud, on Chaf Aleph Amud Aleph. Alpha P, Shayutinokus, Tameim, Benida, Vyoledas. So, mom is tummy. Tosfos says, okay, you're right. Lo yechoshishin ela l'shomer mitumas meis to buy a hazav umitumas ayotze migufo kigon balkari. So Tosfos says, look, we can't protect him from every tumma. It's just simply not possible. But from the tummas that we have control over, we're going to protect him from. And then drop to the end of the Tosfos. Tosfos says, and anyway, remember. In other words, just put this in context. The purpose over here is not really to protect him from tumma. That's not the purpose. The purpose over here is to create a counterbalance for the fact that we're going to be Metame, the Kohen, who is burning the Paraduma. So over here, it's just a mala. These are just, these are chumras. These are stringencies imposed just so that we show the world, no, we really do care about Tamatahara, and these are all procedures that are done as a counterbalance. We're not going to protect him from every type of tumah, Tosfos acknowledges, but we will protect him from that which we can protect him from. From tumas meis, and from being a baal kerin.
Even forget about the lettuce, what about a tumah sherit? I mean, there's bugs on the ground.
In other words, right, as pristine an environment we're trying to create for him, in other words, we can protect him from every tumah. Tosfos says, I know that. Okay. All right, now let's go back. Let's answer the question. Right. Right. The water. I mean, I'm not going to answer your question. I'll just ask more questions. The water that they draw. Right. In other words, the culmination of this of their 8 years of preparation is to draw the water in a state of purity. What do they do with that water? And they hand it over to another Kohen, who did not have the 8 years of pristine, you know. Tosfos points this out. This is not my point. So, in other words, again, it goes back to the same point. This is just demonstrative. This is just, and I know it is really an extraordinary method of demonstration to show the world that we do care about Tumat Tahara. So, but it's really demonstrative. We're not going to be able to satisfy every degree of tumma free environment. What do you mean? Okay, but again,
just against tumas meis and tumas balkeris.
Yeah, right. Correct. Okay, so now let's go back to our gemara. Let's answer the question. So the question is, according to Rav Yehuda, you can sleep under the bed. Rav Yehuda says, we did it all the time in front of the Chachamim, and they didn't flinch, they were fine with it. Sleep under the bed? The bed's an ohel. What are you talking about? How could you sleep under the bed? You're not in the sukkah. You're in an ohel within a sukkah. That should be no good. And even Rav Yehuda agrees that once it gets to the point of an agrof, once it's the length and the width of an agrof, I don't care how it was made, natural, man-made, not, doesn't matter. It's an ohel. So what's the sheet of Rav Yehuda? That's the Gemara's question. Let's see the Gemara ask the question. When the top of Chafaf on Midbeis Vare Mita Diyesh Ba Kama Egrofim, the bed has multiple Egrofim. V'tanan Rav Yehuda Omer No Agim Hayinusha Hayinusha Hayinu Yishen Tachas Mita Bifnei Zekanim. And meanwhile, we would sleep under the bed in front of the Zekanim. They didn't mind. So why is the bed okay? Why is the bed not an ohel? Answer: Shani Mita Hol Gaba Asuya. So the Gemara's first attempted answer is, well, you know, the bed, the purpose of the bed is to sleep on top of the bed. And therefore, when talking about an OL, you have to talk about purpose of design. Because the bed was made not to be under the bed, but to be on top of the bed, so therefore it does not have a status of an OL. This is Gemara's first attempted answer. So the Gemara says, Shvarim Nami, go back to the Mishnah Para. Now the Mishnah Para, he has the children riding on the backs of the oxen. Obviously, the backs of the oxen are providing an ohel. To which the Gemara says, well, based on your argument, the backs of the oxen shouldn't work. Dila gabana suyin, meaning what's the purpose of the backs of the oxen? Not to provide shelter, but to ride on the back of the oxen. In fact, in this analogy, the back of the oxen is just like the bed. So as much as we said the bed isn't a tent, neither should the back of the oxen. So remember the days when we would shepherd? I don't. But what the shepherds would do is that they would use the animals, specifically the oxen, as shelter. Shelter from the cold, shelter from the rain, shelter from the sun. In other words, they would lie underneath the oxen in order to provide shelter. So the Gemara says, Yachi mita nami, ho megina amenal v'sandam shetachtaha. You don't store anything under your bed? You don't put shoes under the bed? Sure we do. So as much as we were going to argue that the oxen is used for some purpose of shelter, so the bed is also used for some purpose of shelter, we put our shoes under our bed. By the way, do you notice the Gemara says, what do we put under our bed? We put shoes under the bed. Are you allowed to put other things under the bed? Rashi here writes, no, you're not. You're not allowed to put other things under the bed. It's based on the Gemara Baba Basra. Rashi here quotes the Gemara Baba Basra. You want to see the Rashi inside? Rashi is right when the lines start becoming narrow towards the top. Rashi writes, we don't put on other things under the bed. The Gemara Baba Basra says, Ezu mita shal tamid chachamim. What's the bed of tamid chachamim? Kol she'ein tachta ela min alim shel balabais b'yemos hachama v'sandalim b'yemos hagshamim. Shoes are the only things that you put under a bed. Why? Why can't you store other things under the bed? So there are two reasons that are given. One is Rashi right here in our Gemara in Sukkah, and the other one is the Rashbam in Baba Basra. Rashi over here, Rashi, Nosin Sham Kishuhu Balish Kavli Shen Cholet Menalav, Venosin Tachas Mita. So Avalase Tachte Advar Macherim, Genaihu Lo. It is embarrassing to put other things under the bed. Shemargo B'nei Habayis L'Sham. Because if you store other things under the bed, so that means people are going to come into your room all the time, getting the things from under the bed where you're storing. People coming into your bedroom, not appropriate, right? Pasnish, very well said, no good. That's Rashi over here. Rashi said that's Rashi's very simple rational explanation in terms of why you shouldn't store things under your bed, because you don't want people accessing your bedroom. Good. The Rashbam in Baba Basra, now mind you, Rashbam was the grandson of Rashi. Okay, so perhaps he knew the Peshat, he learned with his grandfather. But whatever the case is, Rashbam gives a more metaphysical explanation of why you can't store things under the bed. The Rashbam over there writes, it has to do with Ruach Ra. Okay, it's bad spirit. Some metaphysical explanation in terms of why you can't store things under the bed. Anyway, back to our Gemara. What's the difference between a shur, which is an oel, according to Rabbi Yehuda, and a bed which is not an oel? So the Gemara tried to say, well, you know, you use the animal shelter, the bed also is used for some purposes of shelter.
Wait, then, I go back to my question. Why don't we have the Rebbe's body acting as a shelter then?
Right, so I guess the body itself, okay, I got to think more about the body. But Ela Amar Rava Shani Shvarim Ho V'asuin L'Hagen Al B'nei Ma'ayim Shalahem. So the Gemara says no. The difference is as follows. The back of an ox provide shelter for the ox itself, which Ben Olin is going to make your question even stronger, but okay, it provides shelter for the ox itself. The pasuk in Eov that the bones and the sinews provide schach. I mean, the pasuk in Eov actually describes it as being schach, meaning so the back of the animal actually is a sukkah. Again, not to be taken out of context. Meaning, but the point of the Gemara is that the back of the oxen has an ohel status to it, and therefore it serves as shelter. And that's why the back of an oxen is considered an ohel, but meanwhile the bed is not considered an ohel. Okay, that's one possible answer, or the Gemara comes to another possible answer, and this is the answer that Rashi quotes all the way back in the Mishnah. I didn't show you the Rashi back in the Mishnah, but if you take a look back, you'll see Rashi over there. And the Gemara over here gives another basic answer, an answer that we've seen already before in the Gemara. We get to say it now for the umpteenth time. According to Rav Yehuda, a sukkah by definition is a diras keva. It's a permanent structure. Now again, it's odd. We don't hold like this, meaning we hold that the sukkah can be diras arai. In fact, it should be diras arai. In fact, the Gemara in the first daf of sukkah said, because it's diras arai, sukkah can't be higher than 20 amas. Fine, but Rav Yehuda allows the sukkah to be higher than 20 amas. He holds that the sukkah is a diras keva. V'havale mita diras arai. And the bed, at best, is only a temporary structure in terms of being a dwelling place. V'sukkah ol keva v'lo asi ol arai mevata ol keva. So therefore, the sukkah, which is a permanent structure, the bed, which is a temporary structure, the sleeping under the bed, which is an ol arai, will not negate the sukkah, which is an ol keva. That's the Gemara's other formulation in terms of why, according to Rav Yehuda, you could sleep under the bed. So the Gemara says, okay, that's a great explanation for Rav Yehuda. But if you go back to our Mishnah, what did our Mishnah say? Not only does the Tanakhama say you can't sleep under the bed, Rabbi Shimon says you can't sleep under the bed. And Rabbi Shimon quoted a story with Rabbi Gamliel, where Rabbi Gamliel pointed to his servant Tevi and said, hey, look, there's Tevi, and he's an Eved Kenani, and he's not requiring the mitzvah sukkah, and he sleeps under the bed. And we derive from that if you are obligated in the mitzvah sukkah, you can't sleep under the bed. And this is all coming to us through Rabbi Shimon. And as Rashi points out, Rabbi Shimon, we learned earlier, says that the sukkah has to be a permanent structure. How do we know that according to Rabbi Shimon, the sukkah has to be a permanent structure? Great review from what we did in the first parak, because Rabbi Shimon says, how many walls does the sukkah need to have? Four. Rabbi Shimon says the sukkah needs to have four walls, not three walls. Again, we don't possibly like Rabbi Shimon, but that's not the point. The point is that Rabbi Shimon is of the opinion that the sukkah is a diras keva, not a diras arai. So now the Gemara just wonders, So according to Rabbi Shimon, shouldn't you be able to sleep under the bed? The bed is an Olal Arai. The Sukkah is a Diras Keva. So just like we argued for Rabbi Yehuda, that the Olal Arai does not negate the Olal Keva, the Sukkah's Keva, so can we make the same argument for Rabbi Shimon? The Gemara says, that's the Gemara's question. So the Gemara says, this is exactly the machlokas between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon. Mar savar asi ol arai mevat ol keva, or mar savar lo asi ol arai mevat ol keva. In terms of definition, they're in agreement. The sukkah's keva, the bed is arai. What they disagree about is, can the ol arai negate the ol keva? Rabbi Yehuda says it cannot, and therefore it's perfectly legitimate to sleep under the bed, because the bed's just arai. And meanwhile, according to Rabbi Shimon, no. An Olal Arai does, in fact, negate the Olal Keva. Okay.
Why don't we have this whole principle of the Talmidim to be under the humming?
Okay, I understand that. But right now, the Mishnah's point is just simply, in other words, the Mishnah is just dealing with the can you sleep under bed, regardless, irrespective of any other factor. And does the bed serve as its own separate Olal? And again, the Gemara's answer is it does. With exception to Rabbi Yehuda, Amar Rabbi Shimon Ma'isa B'Tevi Avda Tanya Amar Rabbi Shimon Misichaso Shemayim Gamliel Lamanu Shnei Dvarim. From the simple conversation of Rabbi Gamliel, we learn two things: Lamanu Shavad Pter Min Asukah. So the first thing we learn that an Eved is exempt from a Sukkah. Tosfos over here is bothered, meaning that's like a big chiddush, right? An Eved is exempt from a Sukkah. The Gemara says, Tosfos is bothered. Look, we kind of knew that already, meaning. All you need to know is a couple basic pieces of information. An Eved has the same status of a woman in terms of obligation of mitzvot. A woman is exempt from a sukkah, so is an Eved. Yeah. Like, why would we have thought differently? Why all of a sudden did we get wowed with this big piece of information? You know, an Eved is not exactly an obligated sukkah. So Tosu suggests, well, as a hav, just to help us understand why it's such a big chiddush, maybe the teshu came very right. Teshu came taduru, maybe because there's this extra requirement by a sukkah that you have to live in the sukkah like you live in the house. In the house, I live together with my Eved Kanani. So when my sukkah, right, bring out the Eved Kanani. He needs to be there also. How can I live there and take care of myself? Fine. That's a possible explanation of why it was such a novel idea that an Eved is exempt from a sukkah. Anyway, and also we learn from the conversation that if you sleep under the bed, you haven't fulfilled your obligation, because again, the bed's a noel. So the Gemara says, now it's interesting, the language of the Mishnah, right, the language of the Braisa, Sicha Sosha Ramin Gamliel, Sicha, conversation, a casual conversation. Why not dvarav? So the Gemara says, Milsa gavorchi kamashman ki adam arvacha ba'adav amila amarvacha ba'adam arav hamenuna amarav minay she'afilu sichas tamidei chachamim tzricha limud. You overhear casual conversation from tamidei chachamim. Take it seriously, even if they're just bantering with one another. The banter of tamidei chachamim is significant. She'nemar va'alehu lo yibol. First parak of Tehillim. The leaves don't wither. The leaves are not the most significant part of the tree. It doesn't matter. Meaning every part, everything that comes out of the Talmud Chacham, right, is both his meaningful statements and even just his side comment, right, just banter, it's all significant, and we have what to learn from all of it. Okay, we have one more Mishnah and a small piece of Gemara to go. Let's hold this off for tomorrow. Tomorrow we'll start with the new Mishnah and the Gemara, and then we'll get to the Sukkah Meduv Lelas, the double Sukkah, double-decker Sukkah, which I know we discussed before, but here it'll be a little bit different. Okay, we'll stop over here.